Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today for a very special bonus episode of One Heat Minute is, well, a man that I've studied for like 3 years intensively, more than that, beyond this crazy project of One Heat Minute and all of its offshoots. A person who I think has maybe one of the greatest tough guy performances, definitely one of the greatest tough guy looks, and just one of the most fascinating and engaging and captivating roles as Michael Chirito in this movie. He doesn't really need an introduction, but I'm going to give him a proper one because he deserves it. He's been in Spielberg movies, Ridley Scott movies, Oliver Stone movies, Catherine Bigelow movies. He's even in the kind of semi-sequel TV series to this entire film, Robbery Homicide Division. He has the most quotable lines of dialogue in this 166-minute crime epic. In fact, I even own a sweater that has, in gold embossed writing, "The action is the juice." Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tom Sizemore to One Heat Minute. Tom, it is absolutely outlandishly great to talk to you today.
I got it. Thank you for that introduction. It's quite kind of you, and reminds me of a beautiful time in my life working with Michael Mann. And thank you. It's great to be here.
Look, Tom, we have to start. I mean, look, firstly, it's my pleasure to talk to you. So that introduction is the least I could do. People who listen to this podcast have already unpacked every single moment of this movie, sometimes in a multi-length, you know, multi-episodes. And I wanted to just really start off because when we started our conversation, I wanted to sort of play it back for folks who are listening. You weren't aware of the project, but I think that you were, when I was talking to you just moments ago, you were really pleasantly surprised that this is a project that earns that kind of scrutiny, because in your mind, you were like, there was so many subplots, there's so much stuff, you can't miss a thing if you put it under this level of scrutiny. Is that your thought about this kind of crazy project that we've done?
Yeah, I mean, if there's any movie I know of that I've been in or know of that would deserve 1 minute at a time, it's this one. And maybe Citizen Kane. This is on the top of my head, you know, I'm sure there's others, you know. Negatives and Ambersons, The Third Man, Heat. I mean, there's just a few, it's a handful of movies. And in Heat, there's so many things going on at all times. I mean, there's the parole officer and the, you know, Bud Quartz Park, he plays the short order cook who threatens what's his name?
Dennis
with the calling his probation officer or parole officer. It's parole officer. He's on parole. He's out of prison. Unfortunately, I found out what that was about. Anyway, he threatens him with his parole officer, and and then his girlfriend who doesn't want him to do anything wrong, and the heartbreak there, and then what's his name? Who's the asshole we're going after the whole movie?
Well, there's two assholes. There's Van Zandt and there's Wanker. Both of those guys.
William Fichtner is he's an asshole too. Yeah, he's a pussy asshole. Dangerous asshole. I mean, he's dangerous. He'd kill you on the second. That he kills that prostitute, that young girl, and her mother. I mean, just all those moments that you saw in the movie were earned, and they Michael had invested them in his mind as well as on the screen. You know, the mother runs up and Al's Pacino's and Hannah's in the motel. In the car, in the parking lot there, trying to give her some kind of solace, that all those things, you couldn't appreciate them if you just saw the movie. I mean, I didn't appreciate them when I read the movie, and, I didn't get it all for a long time. And I got really close to Michael. I ended up doing a TV show with him, and he's all those lines in that movie, he wrote them. And there's very little, if any, improvisation in a Michael Mann movie because he's able to write it where you don't need to do any of that shit.
Yes.
For me, is the juice I'm in, that's been scripted.
Yeah.
Everything in there is scripted. I mean, it's hard to believe it. All of it is scripted. Everything. And it has that banter that you just can't write like that. I mean, not many people write it. He's the best there is. I mean, what got me about Michael so to this day is no one like him. Is everything you see on the screen is Michael's. The shot, the clothes, the dialogue, the story, everything, the cut, the music, everything is Michael. I mean, he has a costume designer, but he gives her a palette to work from. And yes, she brings him. But Michael is the discerning eye on what it's going to be like. What is it really going to be? It's Michael. As talented as Dante is, it's Michael.
Yeah.
is going to say, this is the palette we're working with. And, okay, here's my choice. Here, you give me these choices. I pick this one and go do it. Okay, no, we're not going to do that. Remember a couple of days, we didn't shoot it at all.
Yes.
Because they couldn't get the light right. That's unheard of. I've never done it with any life. We never rolled a camera. We never shot a frame twice. Yeah. Times. And we were like 18 days behind on day five. I mean, we went 3 months over. Yeah, it's a work of art. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, it was wonderful talking to Dante. And I think you bring up, it's like one time I was talking to Dante, normally talking in the language of someone like educating the listeners who maybe aren't familiar what a cinematographer does. And Dante is really funny. He's like, look, on some films, obviously I work with the lights, I get the lenses, I work with my director to do the compositions of the shots. And sometimes that's more of a collaborative thing. He goes, one of the things about working with Michael, especially as an Italian cinematographer breaking his way into Hollywood, he's like, Michael, I just give Michael the light. Michael's on the lens. Michael composes the shot. Michael actually sometimes knows what lens he wants. Like, he's like, Michael is the guy. Like, that's why I love working with Michael, because he's giving me the instructions of what I need. And I wanted to tag on to what you said, because, some of your, I talked about some of your great lines, and we'll get to some of those conversations, but, just little bits and pieces that I love. And I love so much about your character, Michael Cerito, and is one of the moments when you guys are all, what Pacino's Hannah calls in a convention, you guys are all, your crew's dinner together, and your character says to your daughter, Linda, you go, what do you want to be when you grow up, honey? And she says, I don't know. And you go, just like me, I don't know either. And there's some of those moments that I think you give this color to this guy who is really charming and just like gregarious and like a fun guy to be around, but also has this switch that when he's on the job, like, it's life or death. It's right here and now. And
sociopath.
Yeah, sociopath. Complete sociopath. Complete sociopath.
Sociopath. He's a selfish sociopath. He wants the money. And when he's Neil, that's what we're doing. We're getting money. So, I mean, I don't know what else to tell you, except that Michael draws these characters that are, you just got to follow Michael, and you're going to get... he can be a little harsh. He's an intellectual, very few true intellectuals that make movies, I think.
Yes.
Michael's a real intellectual. And he's just wonderful, man. I don't know what to say about him. He's wonderful.
Can you take us back to something before? Because I've, you know, it was, there was a really funny DVD commentary that Michael did actually with James Caan about Thief. And James Caan completely derailed the conversation about the movie that they were meant to be commentating on to say, Michael, how the hell did you do Heat without me? You got Al, you got Bobby, and like you could have had the trio of Godfather boys. So clearly it was a funny joke at the time, but I feel like in this project, we've learned about so many actors that would like love working with Michael in their career, wanted to, heard about this movie and just would have fought tooth and nail to get a, to be a part of it. Can I ask, how did you become a part of the film? Because I, you know, that's some of those pieces of this movie coming together, and someone like yourself who I, you know, we've even played the game on the show before. Like, how could you ever recast this movie? And I almost have as difficult a time of recasting this movie as I do The Godfather. Like, I'm like, I don't know who else you get in the different ages. It's so hard to pick people who are complimentary to and can stand up on the screen with De Niro and Pacino at their best at this time in their career. So how did you become a part of this movie? Did you know about it and go, I have to be a part of this movie?
No. I didn't know about it. It was a real hush-hush in Hollywood. Bob saw vis-a-vis Sean Penn, he saw True Romance. And
right.
And I'd done a movie with Bob De Niro called about the Hollywood, the Hollywood 10, the McCarthy hearings. I played Sam Cohn. I played the attorney, and what was it called? God, I can't remember. But it was just one scene. So Bob knew me, and he saw that scene, and he saw the movie True Romance, and then he was invited to a screening of Natural Born Killers, and he called Michael the next day and said, I think I know who should play Chirito. And I was told all this by Michael later, much later, when the movie was over. And I got a call from my agent that day. I found out later that Michael and Bob had talked. And then I had a meeting with Michael the following week or a few days later. And they were going to send over. I had to go into his office and read the script after hours or some shit. It was you couldn't get this. It was under lock and key. For an actor like myself, I mean, Bob probably had a script, and Al had a script, I'm sure. So I went in and read it, and then I went in and took the meeting, and the meeting doesn't stand out of my mind that much because Michael had kind of made up his mind to cast me.
Wow.
I remember he asked me, do you feel like you can stand up? Can you stand next to De Niro? And I go from a tight De Niro to you and, you know, dropping the level of, I said, what do you mean? Are you asking me if I'm as good an actor as Bob De Niro? can you get your game up here and keep up here? And the physical demands, I just want to let you know that these robberies, these guys do these high-end robberies where three guys can take on a police force of 2,500. These guys are in condition. And I said, well, I can get in that kind of shape. And yeah, I think I can stand up next to the Bob De Niro or Robert De Niro. He's been my idol since I was a teenager. And it would be a dream come true and stuff. And he said, okay, I'm going to hire you then. I was right there in the room. So when I went to my car, I didn't have time to be kind of bowled over. I was sitting in my car and I didn't call my agent to tell him I got hired. And it was wild. And then this is wild. It was November, and I went home for Christmas to Michigan. I lived in L.A., and I went back to Michigan. And I was home. It was Christmas Eve. And my father's landline rang. And my dad yelled out and said, he goes, Thomas, Michael Mann's on the phone.
What a Christmas present. What a Christmas present.
Are you going to be away for the holidays? And if you are, do you have a contact number? Michael might want to talk to you. I said, oh, sure. My dad was in Michigan, 313-839-6081. That was the number. So I gave the number, and he called on New Year and Christmas Eve and said, I'm sorry about this scheduling deal, but we didn't think we'd get this location for, I said, location? We don't shoot the movie until March. We start March 7th. He said, location for rehearsals. I said, rehearsals of what? And he goes, of the robbery. we're going to start, I didn't explain, so we're going to do the robbery. We're going to rehearse for 6 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Rehearse for 6 weeks? And I was thinking in my head, as my agent, I'm going to rehearse for 6 weeks. Of course, they didn't know. They just totally told them that day also. And but this location became available. And so, but we have to start, if I want to get the time I want, we got to start now. So I need you to fly back to L.A. tonight. Or no later tomorrow to work the 26th of December. And it's just a rehearsal, though. And we start when at dawn, which is like a 6:50. And we're done at dusk.
So, Jesus. And dusk in L.A. is like 8 p.m. it's Jesus Christ.
Okay. We started out with the simplest of deals. And then, you know, by the end of it, we were, you know, you saw the magazine change that Val did. You saw the way we handled those weapons. We weren't virtuosos, but we were pretty damn good. And so I flew back to Los Angeles the evening of Christmas, and I was there the following morning. And I drove out to where Magic Mountain is, and it's where the LAPD, where we rehearsed, where the LAPD used to have their police, what's it called? You go to the police academy. That's where we rehearsed on one of their shooting ranges. And as well as Al's group was doing simultaneously working with their weapons on an adjacent, but we couldn't see them, on an adjacent shooting range. And both parties that were involved in that shootout rehearsed from the 26th of December until the beginning of March. And then we had 7 days off. We started the movie March 9th, 1995.
That is so unbelievable. I'm just like, as the biggest fan of this movie, I am just bowled over, but I'm also completely not surprised. But one of the things I was just going to say, though, you kind of talked down your ability, you guys, you and Val, but people have been chasing the dragon of this movie for 25 years. You know, it was only a couple of days ago that the 25th anniversary of the Burbank premiere came and went. And
to catch the tail of this movie. They're not going to catch it.
People have been chasing it forever, Tom. Like, and I feel like someone who ever goes, oh, this movie's great. You know, it feels like it's inspired by Heat. Whenever anyone says that, like, you just don't compare it to the best that it's ever been done. You're just only setting yourself up for failure. So that's why the alchemy of this movie I love. And that preparation story is just so damn wonderful.
Jordan, the movies, this is LeBron James and Michael Jordan and Larry Bird together. I mean, yeah. Cops and robbers movies, you can't touch it. There's nothing. There's no one near it.
No.
There's nothing. Tell me something that's near it. Story and action and the characters realize the degree to which those are realized in that movie.
Yeah.
He walks with Brenneman in that car. And he's taking off his tie and he sees Pacino run out the street. There's a fadedness to that moment that you knew and he knew. He had his appointment with Hannah. But the moment he found out who the man was, it was almost, he wasn't even surprised. The look on Bob's face when he looks at her like, hey, forgive me, but I got to do something right now. I got to not bring this heat to you. I got to run. That moment was really sad in a lot of ways, but there was a certain acceptance of De Niro. I mean, you got to have such powerful actors, intellectual actors, and of course, what you need most of all is the guy who wrote the story. And Michael had written this movie and had realized these people in his own mind, and to give it to us to do. And there's just no one like Michael Mann. I mean, I've worked with some of the greatest directors of my generation and the previous generation. And I can safely and humbly tell you that no one was like Michael Mann on all fronts. He was the most talented and with it filmmaker I've ever been around.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So let's go back then for everyone for context. Heat is released in December. Is in December of 1995. You start shooting in March and a 9-month turnaround on a grandiose, almost 3-hour crime epic to be shot and then cut. That's a massive commitment for, you know, especially at the time, because it's not as easy. It's much easier now with digital photography and then digital editing and, you know, cutting on the dailies. At the time, Michael Mann had 4 editors, 2 teams that were working almost 24 hours a day that were like cutting footage at the same time. So the things could progress to the natural, you know, as you said, you were 18 days behind at day 5. I love that phrase. But when you guys are making it and you know it's good, obviously you're doing the rehearsal, you've got these guys. Talk to me about like wrapping this movie up and the anticipation of it being released, because I think it seemed for some whatever weird reason the critical response was pretty muted. And in all the research that I've done, there's like sort of outliers that loved it. You know, even like say Manola Dargis, who's now the chief critic of the New York Times, she wrote about it at LA Times and really liked it. There's a few people that liked it. Even Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars, which is pretty good for a Roger Ebert review, but it didn't set the world on fire.
It didn't make a lot of noise. It was shocking. I was shocked. It didn't make a lot of noise. I mean, it didn't get any of the heat, if you'll pardon me. It didn't get any of the heat. Killers got, it didn't, movies I'd been in, it didn't get any of the heat that I wasn't in Reservoir Dogs, I was almost in it. It didn't get any of that type of clamor from the critics or even the town initially. The premiere was well attended, but not sold out. It was strange. I thought crazy. It was crazy, yeah. And then 10 years on, I mean, after the Burbank, the robbery, a couple years on, then it started this groundswell of praise. That's continued apace with movies. That this is a masterpiece of filmmaking. It's noir. It's beyond noir. It's noir beyond noir. I mean, some of the things I've read, but at the time, nothing like that.
Yeah,
just the way it was reviewed, like a good solid caper movie.
And even in the process of this project, when I first kicked off the project, I told people. You know, I said my all-time favorite movie is Heat. And I said, I want to do a podcast where I examine it minute by minute because I feel like it, as a true masterpiece, it stands up to that level of scrutiny. And even at the time, a few people were like, this is crazy. But as the project evolved and more people knew about it and more people were involved in it, and I spoke to such wonderful creatives and actors and people, you know, and even people involved in the film, you know, it as most certainly solidified, like people are like, oh, there's nothing better than Heat. Like that's the, exactly as you said, it's the high watermark in the crime genre and, you know, in a cop robber genre, like there's literally nothing that touches it. And so it's so funny that throughout that time, it just grew and grew and grew. And I think to your point, when you take people away for 6 weeks just to rehearse one of the like gigantic set pieces of the movie, which you then start shooting, you know, in March, and you take people away from their Christmas to their families, the level of preparation and commitment you are putting in this movie, like it's almost like you can't replicate it in 2020 or beyond.
And then you find out that Bob was shooting Casino simultaneously. Flying in, listen to this, the first 3 weeks of the rehearsals, he's flying in from Vegas every fucking night.
Jesus.
Flying in from Vegas after shooting with Marty and Joe and Sharon, flying into L.A., getting a couple hours sleep in the chateau, and then coming over here to the Magic Mountain, former police academy shooting range, and rehearsing for 9 hours, and then flying back to Vegas and shooting. And then when you find out this is Robert De Niro, and he's sacrificing like this during the holidays, and then you get the measure of the man that Michael Mann was to actors. I mean, not only is he doing it, Al Pacino's doing it, but Al wasn't shooting a movie. Bob was shooting a movie, a great movie.
Yeah, his other masterpiece he shot in 1995, you know, like the other great movie of the year.
Yeah. Casino's a masterpiece. People don't give it enough credit.
No. You're an aficionado of him and, of the genre, and you've been in some of the great ones. And I think last year, as the release of The Irishman came around and Casino got its due, you know, like it was like people revisited Goodfellas a lot, but then people went, oh, what's the, you know, the next in this sort of logical Pesci, De Niro, Scorsese trilogy, if you like, which is Casino, which is just equally an outstanding movie. Don Rickles is just so good. And then also you talk about the story of a movie growing. I think Don Rickles on the side telling funny stories about cracking De Niro up and busting his balls on set, you know, builds the lore of the movie, you know, as well. Like, there's great stories that come out of both movies.
We hear those stories after they happen. He would come to the rehearsal and go, I remember him saying to me, hey Tom, what do you think of Don Rickles? You like him? And I went, yeah, he's cool, he's funny. He went, well, you think he's funny? Well, I'm making a movie with him. He said, it's called Casino. Oh, really? And he'd say, and this happened last night. And yeah, I would hear those stories the same day they happened. You know?
Oh my God.
And I thought it was one of Val's best performances, along with the performance in we played Doc Holliday, Tombstone.
Oh, Val, the three of you together, you know, I have cheated the rules of the podcast. Usually what we do is, as the process of our discussion happens, and I'll give someone a minute. I'll give them a minute to view with me, and we'll watch it together. And I'm going to just have to do it in the preamble because I've had too much fun talking to you. But if I had to choose a minute, I would choose for you. And you're not going to know exactly when this is, but I'll tell the listeners too. It's the 77th minute. And the 77th minute of this movie is you, Kilmer, and De Niro on screen together deliberating about what the next steps are going to be. Like, you know, it's that great scene, like, Jesus, where the fuck did this heat come from? That whole sequence. And it's the moment where you say the action is the juice. And I remember all three of you in that scene, and all of the guests that spoke to me in those original episodes, we just were all completely floored by the level of intensity. And I think, as you said it before, when Michael asked you, you know, if I'm in tight on Robert De Niro and then I've got to come in tight on you, do you think you can maintain the intensity? I think in that scene, it's like a holy trinity of intensity. You, Kilmer, and De Niro all just bouncing off of one another. Like, it's an unbelievable scene. Like, it's like, and I think that's some of the best performances is that whole relationship that the three of you have together there. It's amazing.
I agree. I mean, that's the best scene in the movie for me. And Bob and Al's scene is a great scene, but from the scene, that's probably the greatest scene if not the greatest scene I've ever been in my life. I mean, I'll never forget that day. We're shooting up by the where they shot the shootout, where they shot the when Van Zandt tries to double cross him.
Yes.
And Bob's picking up the money and Val's on the roof. That was the first half. That was the day before, and they tidied it up that morning, and then we went right into that scene. It was the same location. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's wild. That was in beginning of May. Beginning of May. Yeah.
So you roll in. You've got these iconic performances that hit. You know, I personally have a real soft spot for you as Agent Dietz in Point Break. I love you as that character. You know, another great LA crime, another great cat and mouse LA crime movie of a completely different style, but a freaking insane. But you then sort of round out the 90s with, you know, Saving Private Ryan, and then lead into Black Hawk Down, two of, I think, arguably the best war movies ever made. And you're here going along, getting a lot of recognition. This is like the peak of, I think, you know, your recognizability in Hollywood. Can I ask you to pivot for a second and go, when does it start to bubble and simmer for you that Heat actually becomes part of the conversation? Because I cannot tell you in the last 3 years how many times people have said, Blake, the action is the juice, or the podcast is the juice, or this, you know, this show is the juice. And I just can't tell you, you know, how many times people have repeated your lines. And especially now, in the world of social media, when someone has a really shit take or is like talking nonsense, people saying, stop talking, okay, slick, you know, like things like that. Like, I just wonder if you have any understanding of how fond we are of your character and your performance, and how that the myth of this movie has grown. Like, I just wonder if you ever, was there ever a moment that you're like, shit, this thing actually is really important. You know, it was as good as we thought it was going to be. It's just taken a while for people to catch up.
There's not a real one moment. I remember when I was doing Dreamcatcher.
Yes.
In 2000, and some of those younger actors, I mean, Tom Jane, who I became good friends with, and Timothy, and the British guy who went on to do the TV show. He plays the guy, the Dreamcatcher. Anyway,
yeah, Damian Lewis. Yep.
Yeah, Damian. Yeah, Damian and Timothy and Tom, and specifically those three guys all came up to me by themselves and told me how much Heat meant to them and what they were like before Heat. I think it was Tom or Timothy said there was before Heat and after Heat. in what he wanted to do as an actor and what movies could accomplish or how far could they reach. And that was the first time a fellow actor, these guys were really, I was a little taken aback, and I was like, really, it has that kind of value to you? Is that valuable of an experience of your life up to now? Yeah, it was like that. Tom actually, Natural Killers, he was really knocked out by that, and he really liked me as an actor, whatever, Tom's just a great actor.
Yes.
He's the greatest blonde haired actor. He and Robert Redford, the two great blonde haired actors. Anthony Hopkins is kind of fair haired too. He would be the best in. But there was no real one moment, but I remember I was in Canada doing Dreamcatcher, and we were in a van freezing our asses off. And when all three of them were talking to me at once, and it was quite something. Yeah. You always know you've done something kind of special talented actors are, there's not a lot of them, but there's some, there's always, when these guys like that praise you, it's uncommon.
It's when your peers stop you and say, no, before we do anything, I need to say how much this movie meant to me. And they, touch their fandom. That's incredible.
Actors are really competitive by nature. I mean, just to try and do this is kind of nuts. Actors are really competitive. And it's just getting a compliment out of someone, a genuine compliment, is rare. It just isn't a very common thing. You're not going to get it from your fellows all that much, unless it is truly magnificently good.
Yes.
And I remember telling my brother this, and he said, younger brother, and he became really good friends with Tom Jane. He said, Tom, it's true, and you really should. It is magnificently good, and you should know that, and you should appreciate that, and feel good about it. You were in a work of art to these guys. It was a work of art, and I always thought art had to be one man, a woman, one person had to be behind it. This group art thing is kind of weird, But because I was grown.
Because my father was. It's so unlikely, Tom. It's so unlikely, Tom. I think that it's so much simpler when you think of a Van Gogh paint. Yeah, when Van Gogh paints a painting, it's one guy and one vision. And as you said, everything that Michael does is, he curates that vision, but he's doing it with 70 speaking parts. And about 40 of those people are some of the best actors that have ever worked. And these huge set pieces and this deep philosophy and these multiple storylines, like how unlikely is it? Like just on paper, how unlikely does that sound like it's going to be anything great?
Exactly. I mean, you got 1,000 people and making that soup. And even if you boil it down, okay, you got the filmmaker, you got your executives, and you have so many people who have to taste the sauce and say, I like the sauce, or you got so many people who got to drink the Kool-Aid and be seduced into saying this is the real Kool-Aid. It's a miracle that something gets through like Heat and Natural Born Killers, worked in the room. Oliver, so many executives, I think, wanted to distance themselves from the movie, that they left Oliver alone. So when it was carpeted by people, they can say, well, we had nothing to do with it, even though our name's on it, we left them alone. But no, it was the opposite thing happened. The critics, pandered to Oliver. And, I think that's because deserves some of the praise you might be giving Heat. It's just a very daring movie. And I think it's Oliver's best movie. Well, maybe Nixon might be better. But,
Oliver at that time, it's really funny when what happens, this is something we've also talked about. It's really funny what happens when people have a run of amazing movies, because some of them hit, and then later on, the people, you know, though, it's actually those movies that are, you know, considered lesser or don't gain as much traction that are sometimes more interesting. Like if you talk about critical reception, Michael Mann's most critically, you know, well-received movie ever is The Insider that happens in 99. But you then look on either side of it and you've got like Collateral and Heat, which are both kind of like crime classics in their own right. And I would argue Heat is, you know, supersedes Collateral in many ways, but it's like you then go and go, wait, and even Coppola, you know, like Rumblefish and Cotton Club and even Dracula to a certain extent. It's like, you've got The Godfathers. Some people forget that you can be having a run. And I think Oliver Stone, you mentioned two, I guess, of the lesser known ones of Nixon and Natural Born, and they're both incredible films.
But they're in the middle of the run. You're right. It started with Platoon, and it ended, I believe, with Nixon, or did he direct U-Turn? And correct me if he didn't.
Yeah, he did U-Turn with Sean Penn. Yep.
Okay, it started with Platoon, and it ended with U-Turn.
Yes.
That's the run. Well, yes. By the time he got Sunday, he's off the run. He's in a different template. He's dealing with a different palette, different things going on in his life.
Yes.
I knew him right after Platoon, and I knew him through the run, of course, and I almost at any given Sunday, I would have done it if I hadn't been doing something else. I don't know what part it was, but it was one of the football players. I couldn't do it. But I did go visit the set. They were in Florida, and Oliver and I got real close, and I went down to visit him, and I could tell that it was different. You could just tell. He wasn't as engaged. He just wasn't as engaged. I don't know how else to put it. He just wasn't as engaged. And that is nothing. This run you're talking about is no more chore than it is with Oliver Stone, I believe.
Yeah.
You can really see that run. Michael's always been up here. He's always hitting at the ball at a high level. He's always John McEnroe or Von Lentil. He's hitting the ball real well.
Yes.
And no matter what he's doing, Thief or what was the last one?
He did Blackout. He's now onto Tokyo Vice, and he was Public Enemies.
He's been doing Tokyo Vice forever.
Yeah,
6 years ago, and he was starting that movie, and he's still doing that movie. He was just starting to write it.
Yeah,
you know, Michael writes them, then he casts them, then he shoots them, and then he cuts them. Okay, the simplest process for Michael, the briefest one, is the shooting. And of course, for me, that's all the glory from Michael. That's way down the line of investment, the time in the movie that the bulk of the time is taken up writing it. You know, that's where the lion's share of the time is. So you get your time between Michael Mann's movies and everyone's working along with them in harmony. It's going to be 3-4 years.
Yeah, the only thing we're all wishing right now, and it's sort of happened with someone like Terrence Malick, is like the gaps between the movies are quite big, but we want them to be. We want less of a gap because we just want more stuff because we want more Michael Mann things. So we're just like, please be like Terrence Malick and make one movie a year for the next 5 years would be really nice because we don't want to wait 3 or 4 years between them anymore, please.
You're not going to get that from Terry. I was cast in the other, Ryan, what was it called? Thin Red Line?
Thin Red Line.
I was cast in that movie as Elias Koteas' role. And it shot the same time that Saving Private Ryan shot. And I was cast in both. I was cast in both of them. I was cast in Terry's movie the week prior to Steven giving me the offer. And getting cast in Terry's movie was very difficult because it was only Sean in the movie and then Nick and then me. And I had to tell Terrence Malick on the phone that I was not going to do his movie. I was going to do Saving Private Ryan. And I just want to say he cussed me out, which I didn't think he would do. Of course, I didn't know him that well, of course. I don't know if anybody does. But I just knew the movie, you know, with Martin Sheen and God, my brain, I'm getting older. Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek.
Badlands,
right? Yeah. That's all I knew about Terrence Malick. And then, of course, I went through this casting process with him, which went on for like 3 months. It was strange. I had been at Hamburger Hamlet like 6 different times for lunch. Hamburger Hamlet on Sunset over there, you know, right where the strip would end. And and we had this strange read through at Mike Medavoy's home that was attended by there should have been like 35 actors there, and there were 7. And wow. They're passing out these roles, and you're going to read these 6 parts. You're gonna read these. It was a strange thing, and it was all for Malick to see me in certain situations. I asked Sean before I was cast, "What's he doing? I mean, what do I got to do to make him decide yes or no?" And he goes, I don't know exactly. I mean, I just met him a year and a half ago or something. And we've been working on this. And Elias replaced me. Those kind of guys, those guys are auteurs. You're just not going to get a lot of, you're not going to get a lot of material from them. And the proof is in the pudding. Look at the movies.
Yeah. It's so funny that like two of the greatest American war movies ever made are made at exactly the same time, completely tonally different, doing completely different things, but arguably, both completely iconic, both hugely influential. And, you know, I think your Sergeant Horvath is maybe as good as it gets. So I kind of like, I can't imagine any other person in the whole world playing that role. So to be honest, it's like, maybe you've definitely made the right choice, I think. I still want to imagine you in The Thin Red Line. I think that would have been the craziest thing if that could have happened. You've been in the two 1998 war movies. That would have been insane.
Right. Malick, isn't that wild? They both did it that summer. Those two men they kind of retired the World War II genre too. It was done. When those came out, the last word on World War II has been said in a way. Movies. You remember Elias Koteas' part in Thin Red Line?
I do. I love Elias Koteas. As an actor. One of our next projects, Tom, is actually we're doing what's called the Zodiac Chronicle, going through David Fincher's 2007 Zodiac, and Elias Koteas is in that movie. He plays Jack Mullinax as one of the Vallejo sheriffs, and I'm a huge fan of his. He's incredible, and he's great in Thin Red Line.
Great actor. Bears a younger Elias bears a resemblance to De Niro.
Yeah.
You look at him.
Yeah, they do.
Same hair.
They're also both wiry because, you know, back in their youth, they were really wiry and sort of like they haven't got that kind of bulldog shoulders yet. They're very wiry.
And both real weird and real wiry. You're right. Yeah.
Real weird and wiry. That's it.
Great guys. Both great actors.
So, Tom,
they've been hitting the ball hard for 45 fucking years, man. 50 years.
I think people sleep on both Pacino and De Niro. And you only have to watch them in something like The Irishman and everyone's like, oh, they're amazing actors. Or like, you know, with De Niro more recently, it was something like Silver Linings Playbook or a couple of those other ones. And they're like, oh, he's a great actor. And they're like, it's like Meryl Streep. Like these guys are they're so good that they just crush almost, you know, if they have the right material and they're in the right environment, they can do anything. And I think it's a really interesting thing that Pacino said in the lead up to The Irishman is like, I started, you know, there's a certain point in your career where you can decide if you get a crappy script, you think that you maybe can do something with it. And he's like, and I've acted in plenty of movies where I thought I could bring something more to elevate a crappy script. And he's like, and sometimes that doesn't work. And more often than not, it doesn't. And he's like, but you still go out swinging, but they're all a mate. Like they're all every one of your crew and the extended family of Heat, like all of those actors are unbelievable. Ashley Judd is amazing. You know, she kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. Val is absolutely incredible. Michael T. Williamson, Wes Studi, still crushing it all over the place. Ted Levine, you know, the Buffalo Bill, like amazing. All those guys.
Demi is great in the movie, isn't he?
Yeah.
What's it? The guy who played Buffalo Bill in John.
Yeah, Benji's yeah, movie. Yeah, yeah. Ted Levine. Yeah, he's wonderful.
That's just a great cast. But it is true though. You're right. People don't appreciate De Niro and Pacino the way I do. Your average person doesn't seem to get it. The average man did bring it home for certain people. Like, oh, they've been doing this since 1671. You know.
Yeah.
Godfather was 72, wasn't it?
Yes, 72. Yeah. 72.
Wow.
And 70, 72 and then 74 respectively. Like, and I think the conversation of the Godfather.
Bob read for the Godfather and he was up for Michael and for Sonny.
Yeah.
And he would get into it all sometimes. It was really funny. You know, if the casting director hadn't thought he was so talented, he tested for both of them and didn't get in either one and was really, really disconsolate, but was told by Fred Ruse, Francis's producer, that Francis has a plan for you if this movie works out.
Yes.
And I was like, this movie works out was a big sentence.
Well, yeah, it's only the whole fate of Paramount Studios is riding on this movie. So it's fine. You know, if it works, it works. That's the beautiful thing about the internet, Tom, is, you know, every now and then, I think it happens every few months when The Godfather comes back into conversation, but like the De Niro audition tapes for Sonny emerge, you know, they're on YouTube or something and someone puts a clip on, and, you know, the sliding doors moments of, you know, who would have been Michael and things like that. And it's like, you know, sometimes the universe, like fate, is whispering to someone. And I think at Francis during that peak of his run, I think he had a line into the universe, you know, and having Al and then, you know, and then having Bob for Godfather Part Two, like all of the stars were, you know,
they became a star in Tom Cruise's generation. I mean, they're all in The Outsider.
Yes.
Including Tom himself. Yes. They're all in the movie. From Matt Dunn, how crazy. They're all in the fucking movie.
Yes.
You know, Francis, and then you discovered Michael. He discovered Al and Bob in a lot of ways, you know, and put him in a big studio movie. I mean, Al had only done The Panic in Needle Park, and Bob had done like the thing with Shelley Winters and these really little low budget movies. And then Francis is the one who put both those men in the public eye. Give him a big stage and put him bright.
And again, talk about chasing the dragon. You know, fortunately, there's someone as talented as Marty Scorsese that does things like The Goodfellas and The Irishman, because, you know, people have been chasing that mafia, you know, dragon for many years. It took The Sopranos on TV and someone like James Gandolfini to, you know, to reach the same heights as The Godfather and Godfather Part Two. But it's like, it's, you know, I like to call them genre ruiners. And I think Heat in many ways is like a crime genre ruiner for a few years, because people just, they don't know what to do. Like, it hits a new height and it takes a new paradigm to shift, or to make a smaller scale thing or a larger scale thing, or take it to a more serialized narrative. It takes time for things to sort of get back under their feet once these seminal texts are made. And, you know, I think the Godfather's and Heat's and that synergy, it's crazy.
Heat's the Hamlet of being indecisive about what you should do with your life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the story on puberty, or, you know, a lot of people say Hamlet's about a lot of different things, but Hamlet can't make up his mind. You know, he doesn't know what to do. And he did just kind of, like, wrote the book on cops and robbers. Here it is. Here's cops and robbers. And if you're gonna do it well, this is the post. This is the signpost. This is the high water mark. This is the high water mark. You gotta get near it at least if you're gonna go and do it, or you shouldn't do it. Yeah, they did. He did.
Well, Tom, I just wanted to say, I just want to say, firstly, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. I know that we were probably meant to promote your new movie, Central Park Dark, which we will do in a moment. But I just wanted to say, from the bottom of my heart, as a person who's dedicated my life to this movie for many years, it was my dream to get creatives such as yourself, who are a part of it, to be on the show in any way, shape, or form. And the opportunity to talk to you today is amazing. And I've had such a great chat with you, and it's just been a joy. I'm gonna listen back to this myself with a massive smile on my face. And I just want to say thank you so much for being a part of the show. And thank you for this performance, because it is truly in I think the best crime film ever made. It is truly one of the iconic performances with the iconic lines. And it's just a treat talking to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Blake. Thank you very much, too. Thanks.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.